House of Grace, your podcast home for the big and small questions and answers of life with Sandra von Sapienski.
So it is such an honor to have you in my podcast. I was so excited when you wrote the Facebook message with a yes.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
And I have read, and on your, I think it was on your website, you had so many descriptions of what you are, or more what you're doing, or what you were doing. You were a stock options broker, you are a surfer, painter, poet. And I was wondering, how would you describe yourself? Or do you see a kind of a shared factor in all the things you are doing?
Well, I'm an artist. I'm a spiritual seeker. But most of all, I'm just a person. And so all of these jobs, what they have in common is me. I have a wide range of interests. I'm kind of a multi-valent person. And mostly these jobs came up because they were natural at the time, and they helped me to focus on whatever project I was really interested in. So for example, working in a mountaineering and ski shop allowed me a very flexible schedule so I could be out in nature. It didn't pay much, but it also allowed me to tour as a poet. I spent many years as a professional poet, running poetry shows, but also performing around the country. And so I needed a job that was flexible more than one that made money. So if you just looked at my resume, it might not make a lot of sense, like what holds them all together. And usually what holds them together is that they allowed me to pursue my interests as a spiritual practitioner, as a writer, a poet, and as an artist. So most of the jobs you see listed really weren't my primary interest or my primary source of income.
And also stock options broker. I was wondering, yep. I was wondering about the stock options broker.
Well, I was dating a really charismatic and talented poet who broke my heart and stole my money, and like an old country and western song. And I was suddenly thrown into a situation where I needed to make a lot of money very quickly. Mm-hmm. And I had a friend work at the stock market, and she said, they're always hiring. And it was actually stock options. I was working at the Pacific Stock Exchange in San Francisco, mm-hmm. on the options floor. So it's a very, very stressful environment, and you have to be able to do math very quickly off the top of your head, at least back then. So the turnover of employees is rapid because it's such a stressful place to work, and most people just can't handle it. But apparently they really like to hire artists because we've got an emotional outlet to handle the stress. So it was actually contrary to what you might think, being a poet and an artist was actually an asset and helped me to get the job.
I was also, when you said in your stock options broker job, you needed to be very good in math. You are also mm-hmm. very good in math, because I am also a lot into writing, and I so much mess up with numbers, but you handle both.
Well, I believe the mind is a lot like the body, and mm-hmm. that if you exercise your skills, you get better at them. I'm a very, very disciplined person, and I believe in what do they call brain flexibility or mm-hmm. mental flexibility. I really, really believe that, what do they call it? Mental plasticity. And I might not be very good at running, but if I exercise every day and I focus and I train, I will become really good at running very quickly. And so that's what I did. I just started practicing my fractions every day as if my life depended on it, or my income. And I picked up the math relatively quickly, and I've lost it again. I can't tell you what nine teenies plus 3/4 is off the top of my head anymore. It'd take me a minute, you know? Mm-hmm. The nomenclature, also there's a certain vocabulary or slang on the floor that you have to pick up really quickly. But I picked it up to such a degree that I was actually teaching the new recruits after a couple of years. So I believe that we all have those abilities, and we make a definition or an identity around ourselves as being good at some things and not other things. And it's true that we have natural talents. There's no question that we have aptitudes. But I really, really, really think that people become limited by their own ideas of self. And I believe this is reflected in the yogic tradition. And part of what doing asana yoga is supposed to help us to learn, not only that we have skills and abilities and muscles that we didn't even know existed, but that, our old definitions of self and what we thought was our range of motion is really, to some degree, self-imposed.
It's very interesting what you said about asana, because I was also interested, as you are a yoga asana teacher as well. Mm-hmm. How do you experience asana, and how much is it a part of your practice? And well, how disciplined are you with that? I guess you're very disciplined, because you're said you're a disciplined person, but I would be also interested in how you think, how much... So actually, there are two questions. Mm-hmm. The role of asana in your practice, mm-hmm. and the mm-hmm. second is the role of discipline in living a spiritual life.
The role of asana in my practice, it was primary. I was very closeted, you might say, or bashful about my spiritual practice before I came into yoga. Mm-hmm. Because I was a coach, like almost like speech and debate for poets. I was touring the country as a public speaker and an MC and hosting events for my living. I was looking for somatic methods to help people relax, because competitions and public speaking are so stressful. Public speaking is actually considered one of the most traumatic experiences somebody can have, after like death of a parent or moving into a new home. And so even professional speakers need methods to get back in their body, get out of their head, relax. I first came to asana yoga, physical yoga, hatha yoga, looking for methods to aid with my coaching practice and to help especially traumatized at-risk youth to speak up and speak out and share their experiences of oppression and struggle and triumph. Then I realized how much more there was to the practice and dove deeper. And I still haven't, I thought that I was just going to go in and sort of take a few body awareness techniques and relaxation techniques. And I figure, oh, I'll just master this yoga thing and then go back to coaching poets and being a speaker. And I'm still working on that master yoga thing, you know, 20 years later. The way I came into yoga is not where I am now. I consider the art that I do to be the fruit of my yogic practice, mm-hmm. rather than my yogic practice being a tool to make art. And that's because I'm no longer making conventional Western art, I'm making sacred art. And sacred art needs to have transmission power, and it needs to inspire people. And part of how it inspires people is by getting into the state, the energetic state, that the artwork portrays. Mm-hmm. So I don't just try and draw a picture of a goddess. I really try to experience her and then make a portrait of that experience of meeting that divine person. Now today, my practice, it depends on who you compare yourself to. I know some incredible practitioners, and so I don't feel like I'm very disciplined. Because, you know, I taught for so many years. I know people who are extraordinary asana practitioners, but compared to most people, I've been told I'm extremely disciplined. I'm almost a daily practitioner of asana yoga. I am a daily practitioner of puja and japa, which means utilizing an altar to invoke the deity, and japa is the recitation of mantras. So I typically spend anywhere from half an hour to 4 hours every day in seated meditation. And anybody who's spent that kind of time sitting still without moving or going to the bathroom, you know, mm-hmm. knows that asana yoga is the most helpful thing you can do to aid with the body, strengthening the body, so that you can spend that much time in meditation.
And you just mentioned your art, and that's how I how I got to know you through your art. I saw the your drawings in Shakti Awakening and in Tantra Illuminated, and on my altar there are also pictures of your art. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's really hard to sort the questions because it's like I have a million and all want to go out at the same time.
Right, of course.
So how and when did you combine it? You know, when did you start to paint and to draw the beautiful yantra mandalas you're doing and the yantras and the pictures of the gods and goddesses? Was there a certain time or a special experience?
Yeah. Yes. There's actually a lot of questions. You have no idea how many questions are packaged into that one question. It's great.
Yeah, I know.
I'll tell a story that I think will answer all of them, and I'll try to keep it brief.
You don't have to.
Okay. Good to know. If it stops being entertaining, let me know. I was a world-renowned, and I say that with some humility, because I spent a long time, but I won international championships. I became very well-known as a vocal coach and as a strategic competitor within the Poetry Slam community. Mm-hmm. I was one of the very best in the world. And I did not expect or want to have a second career or another hobby. It occupied all of my time. But I did recognize how much time I spent as an artist up in my head and not in my body. And so even then, even before I was doing yoga, I would go for walks, I would go rollerblading. I knew that physical exercise was absolutely necessary for my mental, emotional, and physical health. Mm. I didn't really understand that my spiritual health was suffering. Once I started engaging yogic practice, I realized that there was a lot more there than I had expected to find, and more than I thought I was looking for. I took my first yoga class, and it was at a Bikram studio, and I went up to the teacher after the class and I said, "This was brilliant. These yoga posture things are amazing, and I really want to understand how they work, why they work." And she's like, "Oh, yeah." She was very blasé. And as you know, in that style of studio, the teachers are often just trained to parrot a specific script.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
I started as well with Bikram.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. It was my entry point. There's a studio right down the street from my house. And so I don't fault anybody for doing that particular sequence, especially if they're looking for physical results. I need to pay respects if that's where I came into the Dharmic path. In any case, I asked the teacher, because I had taken martial arts, I'd taken modern dance, and I had my own sort of ultra secret spiritual practice that I didn't admit was a spiritual practice because I thought that was some hippie stuff and I didn't want to admit it.
Can you tell? Can you tell what kind of super secret spiritual practice it was and feel it?
I did do regular a regular seated meditation practice, although I didn't really call it then. Mm-hmm. I had profound visionary experiences. I had a dream practice, which I mm-hmm. still do. I can wake up in my dreams and do things mm-hmm. and learn things and go places and visit people. When I'd worked in the student bookstore in college, there were books on yoga and I didn't know anything about it. I didn't want anything to do with that weird Hindu stuff, that hippie crap, right? But I loved the postures of people and I used them because I was a visual artist specializing in the human figure. I used them as models to draw murals of human figures intertwined with one another. And I copied some of the poses to stretch. And so I had my own entry point into the asana tradition because of the books that I saw. Mm-hmm. In any case, I didn't really think of that as a cohesive spiritual practice, but it was my nascent yogic practice before I was willing to admit what it was. And when I moved to Berkeley, there's a lot of Indian shops. I'd bought a huge poster of goddess Kali and put it up over my computer as inspiration when I was working on poems and debating people around the country and had no idea who she was. I just thought she was hella sexy and incredible, and the poster was awesome. So yeah, I was just being a dude. I just really didn't have any sensitivity to what was going on. So I took this class, and at the end of the class, it was my first class I'd ever gone to. My wife took me to the class. And I was doing it as something for us to do together. I didn't really want anything to do with this yoga stuff. And I thought the class was so brilliant, the sequence of postures and the postures themselves, and then the experience that I had. Mm-hmm. I went up to the teacher, and I had this experience as a martial artist and as a dancer, and I'd done my own practice and felt and experienced things. And so I recognized that there was something more going on in the class than just stretching. And I asked the teacher, I said, why did we start every yoga posture with the right side of the body? Why does every posture start with the right foot? And the teacher said, I don't know, that's the way Bikram does it. I said, yeah, but this is really brilliant. I mean, I can tell that there's more than just stretching. There's some kind of logic to what we're doing. There's a pattern. And she goes, it works for me. I don't need to know anything else. Mm-hmm. And I kind of nodded my head. She says, buy the book. I bought the book, which did not tell me why. And I realized that both she and Bikram himself really did not understand, or at least in his case, he didn't articulate the actual logic of the practice itself, why it functioned the way it did, what it does to the body. And of course, he learned that sequence from his own teacher, as we now know, and almost completely plagiarized it from his own teacher in Calcutta. So he was just copying. It's like copies of copies of copies. So I went on a search, and because I was touring around the country as a poet, and I was in lots of different cities, I'd go into every city and take a yoga class. I'd ask, who is the top instructor? And I'd take the yoga class, and after the class, I would ask, why do we start every posture with the right side? Because almost everybody all over North America does the same thing. And that information has become more common now, but back in 1997, oh, no, what was it? That was, no, it was a little bit later than that, early 2000s. In the early 2000s, nobody really understood why. Nobody I talked to. And it took a couple of years before I found somebody who could answer my question. And because I'm really lucky and the goddess has a sense of humor, that instructor was based at a studio about 5 blocks from the house my wife and I bought.
That's perfect.
So I was very grateful for that. And I began studying with him, and I really disliked him personally. No offense to that
teacher.
What did
he tell you?
Pardon me?
What did he tell you about why you are studying with the right foot?
Do you want to guess? Why do we start in yoga asana classes? Why do all these teachers initiate their motion on the right side?
I guess it could have something to do with the ego.
Well, of course, I mean, the short answer is yes, but the longer answer is no.
Tell me the long answer.
I went up to this teacher and I said, so why do we start every yoga posture on the right side? I said, oh, that's easy. It's because we're activating Pingala Nadi.
Oh, okay. Because of the Nadi.
And I was like, what? Not pig what? And he called his students over. He goes, hey, everybody, this is a great question. Why do we start every yoga posture on the right side? It goes sun and moon, right? Pingala Nadi, Ida Nadi. Pingala Nadi is the solar nadi. It's the solar side. It's the red nadi on the right side of the spine. And he said, all these hippie yoga instructors in the 60s all went over to India, and they only studied for a couple of years. And to purify their karmas, because they're all hot-blooded, crazy, horny yoga enthusiasts from America in the 60s taking drugs and getting them free love and all that, they gave them sun salutations. And most American yoga is based on Surya Namaskar, on sun salutations. Mm-hmm. And of course, when you're doing sun salutations, you want to activate the solar channel. So you activate the right side, you initiate with the right side of the body to initiate that particular solar nadi. And he said, but the problem was that they all went there, they started getting results, and then they left, and then thought they were geniuses. They didn't complete their training, but thought they were good enough to start teaching people. And so they never taught anybody anything about Chandra Namaskar, moon mm-hmm. salutations, and how to open up the lunar channel. And that helps to explain why there's so many sex scandals in the wider yoga community. Mm-hmm. It's because people are activating that hot-blooded solar channel of personal charisma and shining brightly, but they're not opening the watery lunar channel of connection and emotional nurturance, the slow, gentle feeling qualities associated with the moon. And so you're getting people that are really, they're moving Kundalini. Kundalini really doesn't want to fit into Pingala Nadi. It's too small. She wants to move through the central channel. But if you force her through tons of disciplined physical practice in pranayama every day, you get very weird results, very imbalanced results that makes people a little crazy, a little too hot-blooded.
It's so interesting. Can you imagine? I have 1,000 hours teacher training in yoga asana and nobody told me. Honestly, I mean, I know that there is a Chandra Namaskar and sun salutations, but why we are starting with the right or with the left one, left foot? I think nobody starts with the left in Germany as well, or very rare.
Yes.
So I'm super happy about this podcast because I can, when I teach asana, I can adjust.
Well, if you're teaching asana in the morning, it's appropriate to start with the right side. Yeah. But if you're practicing or teaching at night after the sun is set, it's appropriate to start on the left side.
Yeah. And also when you are using asana for like moving energy, going really inward and, being very slow and quiet and more in a explorative state of awareness while you move just maybe slightly, just very slowly and with not so much movement.
All of those things are true. And I like to go back to the teaching from the Ayurvedic tradition, for whom and when. So medicine for one person may be poison to another. And so the point of doing asana practice, as far as I'm concerned, is to understand ourselves and move beyond the place of just following rules and books, but to actually have enough sensitivity to our body that we adjust skillfully. I mean, one definition of yoga is skillful action, but to actually adjust the practice to suit our specific circumstances and needs, and to ultimately move for a place where we move intuitively without strategic thinking. And it's something my guru emphasizes a lot, that the higher levels of practice, you need to actually shut down the discursive mind. So no self-evaluation is possible in that state. You simply move from a place of flowing awareness, which is the example that Saraswati gives us.
It's so interesting that you're saying that, because my asana, my very private asana practice changed so much into like that. And I don't know if you, and now it's getting really weird. I don't know if you have experienced that, but, or if it's common, I have sometimes the feeling when I'm really like deep into it, that I move the energy, the atoms around me, and I can feel my energy body moving as well. It's not the body made of flesh. It's also, I'm more and I move more and I move the whole room. And I know it sounds weird.
I do know that sounds weird, but it's absolutely what is meant to happen. It's experience you are supposed to have in this style of practice. And congratulations, good job. Good job for giving yourself permission to do that, because most people will stop themselves thinking, oh, that's ego or that's vanity or that's fantasy or that's imaginary. And not understand that that's actually where the practice is meant to go. Mm-hmm. And because that's certainly what I did. It took, you know, years and years and years of study with teachers hammering it into me to understand that my physical body is only the smallest, densest kosha. And our actual body, much of it is not visible to the physical eye. It's actually much larger, including up to the size of the room, and then including it up to the entire universe.
Can I get even more weird?
Sure, let's hear it.
I can see that sometimes. Beautiful. Not always, but I see like, I don't see an aura or something like that. It's more like an energy field, because it moves also when people talk, especially when they are enthusiastic about something, then it grows and it can grow up. I saw it once that it grew up onto the ceiling. And that was quite interesting. I think it looks weird when I see that, because I can't look at the people anymore. It's like, because there are so many things going on around them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but sometimes you can mm-hmm. actually see them. And then they became very true for me. And that this was the mm-hmm. point where I started to move different. And now mm-hmm. it feels different. But now we are talking about me. And
that's beautiful. Well, it's nice because my focus on the visual tradition mm-hmm. and on making art as a spiritual practice, a big part of it is not only encouraging people to use their subtle vision. So we have a subtle component to each of the five senses. I mean, there's more than five senses for sure, but there's the physical senses that see the physical effects, but we also have subtle senses. So there's subtle taste, there's subtle touch, there's subtle sight, there's subtle hearing, right? There's subtle smelling. Mm-hmm. All five of the senses have a subtle component as well. And in theory, at least, ideally, all five of those would be going just like our physical ones, that they would be continuous, not just intermittent. And the fact that for you it's still intermittent, and for me, means that we still have work to do to purify our channels and accept who and what we are in the biggest sense, rather than being attached to a definition of what normal is or human is, and thinking that these abilities are somehow special or extraordinary or siddhis, you know, accomplishments, yeah. rather than just relaxing easefully into our true nature and allowing these things to happen spontaneously without grasping after them.
I don't think they're special. I think everyone has it. And I liked so much Kolbjörn Dammabody, Kolbjörn Martin said once, so what does it mean when you have all these amazing energy experience and this crazy stuff? What does it mean? And he says, especially in terms of awakening, and he says, it means nothing.
Yeah, what does it mean that I can smell? I mean, it means you're human.
And I was like, okay. And there's, like you said, there's humor in the spiritual path, and the goddess has humor. And so I don't think that's special or something which only I have, or yeah.
Well, the teacher that I found that answered my questions was Dharmabodhi.
Oh, no way. He's next week or in 2 weeks, he's on my podcast. Because I'm also studying with him.
Yeah, I met him as Dharmanidhi Saraswati, mm-hmm. and then he changed his name to Dharmabodhi. Mm-hmm. He is now operating on the moniker Cole Martins. He was once Patrick Ronan. So he has had many identities depending on where he's been located and what he's been teaching and which group of people he was teaching to. So when I met him, he was known as Dharmanidhi Saraswati mm-hmm. in Berkeley, California.
And this is also where we stopped. So he answered your question. Mm-hmm. And then we usually, in the beginning, we wanted to tell us what kind of special experience you had when you were studying with the spiritual art. Mm.
So to go back to my story, I searched for a teacher who could answer my questions. And when I found him, Dharmanidhi Saraswati, I began taking classes with him on a regular basis. And I still didn't believe in these Hindu deity things and like putting your head on the ground in front of a statue and all this like weird religious stuff. But I couldn't argue with the results I was getting. Mm-hmm. And I started having more and more profound results. So I eventually took initiation with him. And I decided to suspend disbelief. I was like, all this stuff sounds like some crazy new age bullshit, but I was just gonna go for it. Mm-hmm. So I decided to suspend disbelief for 3 years and just do everything and see what would happen. So I started doing the prostrations in front of the brass statues at the mandir. Mm-hmm. I started doing the breathing practices and the meditations and the visualizations and chanting the mantras. I went to the Ayurvedic clinic and changed my diet and changed my sleep patterns. I did the whole rigmarole. I signed up for the whole thing. I did all the rituals. And I began having incredibly intense visionary experiences, especially after I was initiated into the practice of Goddess Kali. Mm-hmm. And I was very confused by the visionary experiences I was having without going into exquisite detail. But at one point, my teacher looked at me and said, "Where's your picture of Ma?" I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "I want you to keep a picture of her in your wallet like your sweetheart." and I still have it there. I could show it to you. But I had a really hard time finding a picture that matched what I was seeing in these visions. I didn't classify them as visions at the time. I classified them as imagination, that I was having an imaginary experience. I thought I was going crazy. But the experience I was having of Kali was of an incredibly loving and gentle being, which is not how I'd experienced her before. And that's its own entertaining story about how I almost freaking killed myself before I came into yogic practice. Before I was initiated, my experience of Kali was extremely wrathful and I was terrified of her. But once I was initiated.
How was your experience then?
Pardon me?
How was your experience then when you, before you were initiated? When, what kind of wrathful experience did you have with Kali? Can you tell, or is it private? You don't have to answer.
I won't go into all the detail, but remember I told you I bought a poster and put it up over my computer in my bachelor pad. And I just thought that was entertaining and she was awesome. And I had this really very intense experience of destroying the community I was in, or I was blamed for destroying it. The whole thing imploded. Many thousands of people were involved. There was a huge public scandal, which I still do not consider to be my fault. Mm-hmm. But basically, I took a team of extraordinarily talented young poets to the National Poetry Slam. I managed to put together a truly multicultural team from different communities. The Bay Area was very fractured in the poetry scene at the time. And I got, you know, it was almost perfect, like one hip hop poet, one queer poet, one street punk poet, one, you know, I got like one, like they're all like archetypal figures from all these different communities. They freaking hated each other. And so they ended up getting in fights and there was a fist fight on stage at the National Slam. There was threats and the police were called and this huge scandal. And then when we came back, they all blamed me. So that scene completely dissolved and I lost all my friends. I lost my income. My show just went down from like several hundred people every week to just like five or six. I was holding it in coffee houses. But I really didn't think it was my fault. I believed in what I was doing and I stuck with it. And I rebuilt the community even bigger than it was before, twice the size, in fact, many 100 times larger. Mm-hmm. And many new poetry slams sprung up with a whole new group of people that weren't attached to the old paradigm and to their ideas of what community they belonged to. We created this huge, beautiful melting pot of youth poets who were really embracing hip hop, you know, this new aesthetic, this new sound aesthetic, way of putting words together. And not only my slam, but there was more than a dozen new slams sprung up around the Bay Area at that time. And we put together this tremendous community and we went back to the National Poetry Slam the very next year and did something that all the experts said couldn't happen, which is to take a team of people who'd never been on the national stage. And we won. In fact, the San Francisco team tied with the New York team for first place, and then Oakland came in second, and San Jose came in third. Mm. So the Bay Area completely dominated that national competition that year. It was magic. It was beautiful. But at the end of it all, I was so exhausted. Completely emotionally fried from the whole experience, the destruction and the phoenix-like recreation. I went back into my apartment after the National Slam, getting my picture in the New York Times, all of this. And I was like, I need a little less excitement in my life. I'd like to just chill out for a while. And I remember looking at that poster of Kali, still not knowing who she was, and thinking, you know, I think I'm just going to dial things down a little bit. And I took that poster down and rolled it up and put it in my closet. So 5 years later or so, when I came to these yoga classes with this crazy white dude named Dharmaniti, whatever that meant. I mean, I know now, but I didn't then. I said, I'm gonna suspend disbelief and take initiation. I went to this class about the Dashamavijas, the 10 wisdom goddesses. And he said, I don't like to tell people because it freaks them out. He goes, but today you're going to be initiated into the practice of one of the 10 Mahavijas. You'll receive the mantra and that'll be your new tutelary deity, your new spiritual guide will be this goddess, whoever it is. And you're going to take a flower. Everybody in class will get a flower. You'll throw it up in the air. And wherever it lands on this mandala that I hold will be your new Ishta Devata, your new tutelary deity, your favorite. And I was sitting in the back and I was so terrified. I was like, oh no, because Kali was one of those goddesses. Yeah. And so I was terrified that I might get her because I had put her away. I started realizing who she was with all of this training I was getting. And I was like, oh yeah, goddess of mayhem, destruction, ego death. Like, of course I had a hellish experience. I want nothing to do with this chick ever again. And so, I was sitting in the back of the class and I closed my eyes and I'm rocking back and forth. I was so terrified. And like anybody but Kali, nobody but Kali, not Kali, not Kali, just anybody, anybody but Kali, not Kali. Of course, I'm chanting her name. You know, maybe out of fear, but I'm sitting there repeating her name over and over, go over again. Not Kali, not Kali, no, and just not Kali, anything but Kali. And Dharmanidhi walked very softly. He was a trained martial artist. And I didn't realize that he was being mischievous. There was over 50 people in the room. I figured it would take forever for him to get around to me. But he walked softly up to me and I was so preoccupied with my terror that I didn't hear him. He was standing right next to me and he goes, look, I don't have all day. I went, ah, and I threw the flower up in the air. I didn't even look. And he looked at me and he goes, Kali, and moved right on. And I sat there in that moment and my heart dropped through my belly and into the ground. And I had this like moment, to me, it felt like a sinking feeling, but it was a moment of clarity. And I said, I'm going to die. Like I came so close to killing myself last time, I lost everything. And I said, what more can I lose? I said, okay, but I signed up for this. That's what happened. I said, I'm just going to do this with, let's get it over with. And so I learned that mantra that day and I paid attention and I took notes and I practiced it twice a day, every day without fail for years. Mm-hmm. And I thought I was going to just die. And I approached her with great surrender. And there wasn't even terror anymore. It's just like, okay, let's go. I'm going to die. Let's do it. Get it done. And that's why I saw her as Paravak, as this radiant, effulgent source of complete eternal love, because it's no longer afraid of dying. So those who approach Kali who are afraid of death are going to see her wrathful side. But those who approach her with surrender and a certain egolessness, who open that channel without any resistance, are going to experience her as the Divine Mother. At least that was my experience. And so I was very confused seeing a vision of Kali that was radiant crystal voidness and full of love and rainbow light. And I was very confused. I'm like, when is the bloody hammer going to hit? You know, when is my life going to go to hell? When am I going to die? And I thought I was doing something wrong. So I finally made an interview because I was not an inner initiate. I finally made an interview with this teacher and I told him about my experience and I was crying. And I'm like, he's like, what's wrong? I was like, she's just love. She's just pure love. And he goes, yeah. And I said, well, what am I doing wrong? He goes, what do you mean? What are you doing wrong? I said, well, you know, the severed heads, the blood, the, you know, chaos, the mayhem. And he goes, what about it? I said, well, when is it going to start? And he goes, why are you worrying about that? And I said, well, am I chanting for the right goddess? Have I got the right person? And he said, well, say the mantra back to me. I said it back. He goes, no, it sounds fine. I said, so what am I supposed to do? He goes, just keep doing what you're doing. I said, but am I doing it? And he goes, it's fine. And I said, but where's the this? And he goes, just don't worry about it. I said, but, and he goes, and I said, why am I seeing her this way? And he goes, you just must have a very pure heart. And then he just waved me out. He goes, next, and kicked me out of the room. And that was how I came into the practice of Ma Kali. And that's also, it took me years because I was seeing her as Paravak, why all of the pictures of her as wrathful and violent didn't work for me. Mm-hmm. And I kept getting this little whisper in my ear. It's like, well, I needed to get a picture of her and none of them looked right. And I kept getting this little whisper in my ears, well, like, you could draw me. I mean, I'm a trained artist. I went to art school. I wasn't making visual art at the time. I was focused on poetry, but I had the skill set. And I just kept getting this whisper, and I resisted it for more than a year. I had this like strong, I'm not worthy thing. It's like, well, I'm not trained. I haven't gone to art classes, although I did start taking some classes from my Nepalese art teacher, my newer artist teacher, Dinesh Shrestha Charan, or Dinesh Charan Shrestha, depends on when you talk to him. And I bought a couple of books and read up on the art, but I still felt like this, like, it's not my tradition, those aren't my people, I don't know all the rules. But I kept having these really strong visions and this little tickle in my ear. It's like, well, you could draw me. And so one day I just got frustrated. I chose the implements, I read up on Paravak. I'd seen a picture of her, and I'm like, that's the Kali that I see. And I went to a class with this scholar named Harish Wallace, and he'd had another artist draw some pictures of her that just didn't look right to me, way too like sexy, Barbie dollish. But it had her energy. I'm like, that's who I'm seeing, but I need to do my own version. And so I sat down and I did a marathon 8-hour drawing session, and I drew that image of Paravak that Harish still uses today that appears in his book, Tantra Illuminated. That was the drawing, the first deity image I ever drew in one marathon 8-hour session. That was the drawing of the vision I was having of the goddess that was appearing to me. And now that image is on altars all around the world.
Yeah. And in books all over the world. And yeah, readers all over the world get to know a different version of Kali. I mean, in general, all your pictures of the goddesses, and they're so alive. I even had just 2 weeks ago, I had a dream about the, you have this drawing in Shakti Awakening, and the chapter about Lalita Tripura Sundari, and it is love making between Shiva and Lalita. And this was very, I dreamt about this picture, mm-hmm. and I can remember how
well I strive
peaceful it was and alive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I really strive to do what's called darshan images. Images that convey the actual energetic signature of the deity. And in order to do that, you have to, I've told many of the clients who've hired me to make pictures, I can't draw a portrait of somebody I haven't met.
Mm-hmm.
So I always do sadhana for the deity before I draw them. Because I try to provoke some kind of vision, whether it's in a dream or some sign. I just need some sign that the connection is real, that it's alive, before I'll make the artwork. In Sally Kempton's case, she was so famous, and I'd finished Harish's book, but I knew how little I knew. mm-hmm. I felt very bashful about taking such a high profile commission, because I knew those books would be all around the world.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, why don't you hire my teacher, Dinesh? He's so talented. She said, oh yes, his work's very beautiful, but that's not what I'm looking for. I said, well, why don't you hire, his brother Uday, or this person, Mahavir Swami, or, I named a bunch of artists that I knew, Peter Veltevred, in the Netherlands, and all these other people that I was studying with at the time. And she said, I want to hire you because when I look at your images, I feel the goddess, and I want these images to be alive. And when she said that's what I aspire to do, I knew I just had to accept the commission. And so many of the commissions that I accept for illustrations, they can't pay me enough. It's not enough to live on in the Bay Area. These mm-hmm. images require so much work. And because I practice for the goddess to provoke an experience, there's all that time doing sadhana. And I do all this research and look up the dhyana slokas so that I can draw the images properly. That there's nobody can afford to pay me the hundreds of hours I put into every image. So illustration jobs are usually a loss for me in terms of like producing that work. I try to make up for that by selling prints and selling the originals, but I don't take these jobs for the money. I take them when people say, they when we have a shared vision, when we have a shared vision to help these divine beings reach people who are yearning for them, who need them. That's why I take these commissions. And when Sally said that, I knew I had to accept the gig. And she ended up paying me very generously, actually, compared to the typical wages in the publishing industry. Harish was also extraordinarily generous to me. And they both really respected how much work and how much passion I brought to that work for each of the images. And they also knew that what they were requesting was not just a picture. And they knew that that's a nuanced experience that takes time. And they were willing to wait for that and willing to pay for that. And for that, I'm eternally grateful.
I liked it so much when you said, and this is still in my head, that's why I'm asking this now. It's that you do sadhana before you start your art, mm-hmm. that you read the dhyana shlokas, that you meditate. Can you describe or do you have a recommendation for someone who wants to start spiritual art, whether it is paintings, or do you hear my dog snore, by the way, because I have him on my lap, and mm-hmm. I don't know if the microphone just uh-huh. gets the snore. Okay.
Well, if I could be so crass, I would strongly encourage people to go to livingsanskrit.com and check out all of the free classes and the paid courses that I have offering there.
I will also put it in the show notes, and also because I do a post on Instagram and on Facebook, and I will insert everything. So you have free classes, or you have paid online courses where you can study, where we can study with you and just get into the art. Yeah.
Yes. I would encourage people to check out the free classes. We have dozens mm-hmm. and dozens. We also have paid courses, which are more systematic and more in-depth. And we are also going to be offering, starting next year, retreats in India, where people can come and work directly with us. I also run an organization with my partner in India, Mukul. We have a company called Mystic Art Retreats, and I have several events coming up with Mystic Art Retreats starting in October. So if somebody would like to learn about sacred geometry and have a wonderful in-depth experience with Goddess Kanakadhara, we will be making the Kanakadhara yantra, and that'll be up in Dehradun in the mountains under the trees. So there are many opportunities to learn from me directly. And if people don't want to learn from me directly, there are other teachers out there, and many teachers, having a student is like not only a source of income, but the most profound honor and compliment that they can mm-hmm. receive. All of the teachers I've worked with really, really are very tender, at least all my art teachers, are very tender with their students and really want to pass on what they've learned and their legacy. So Dinesh offers private classes here in Berkeley, Dinesh Charan Shrestha. He's hard to find online, but people can find me, and I'm happy to refer them to him. He's extraordinarily talented.
Most of my listeners are in Germany, but maybe the English ones.
Maybe they are. Well, if people want to go and meet these artists in India, I mean, Dinesh's older brother Uday is in Kathmandu, and he teaches students privately. And then Mahavir Swami in Bikaner in Rajasthan, he teaches people for free. Anybody who shows up, he will teach them if they can make it to his studio in Bikaner. Mm-hmm. So all you have to do is get there, and you can stay with him. He has a guest room, or stay in a hotel. The key thing is just to approach these teachers with humility and respect, to ask sincerely, and then do what they say. You know, have some humility. And most of the spiritual teachers that I work with, spiritual art is rather demanding in its own way. It's like people say, well, why isn't this more fun? They think of art as like free expression or as entertainment. They want to be entertained making art. They want it to feel good, to be enjoyable. And they forget that sacred art is like meditation. Mm-hmm. And I mean, was your first yoga asana class fun? Maybe, but the chances are it probably was a little uncomfortable and maybe even hurt at times. Mm-hmm. And people don't seem to have a problem taking a yoga asana class and being uncomfortable, but the first time they take a spiritual art class from me and they aren't entertained and having fun, they get all bent out of shape. Mm-hmm. Because we in the West think of art as entertainment rather than as a way of elevating our soul and expanding our consciousness, as a way of refining our mental and spiritual and energetic discipline. And nobody expects meditation to be entertaining. In fact, everyone understands that it's probably going to be boring as hell the first time you sit for an hour doing nothing, quietly breathing deeply. And if people brought that same attitude to sacred art, it's actually quite a bit more entertaining than sitting with your eyes closed for an hour on a mat. It's really enjoyable, but it is a spiritual practice. It is a discipline and it is meditation. I know one of my teachers, Peter Veltevred in the Netherlands, he said that he was never able to do seated meditation. His mind was too busy. He said, I can't sit still and breathe with my eyes closed because my mind wanders, I get uncomfortable, it's boring. He goes, but the strange thing is when I'm drawing a picture, he goes, I can sit for hours without moving. He goes, it just holds all of my awareness. I love it so much. So sacred art is a discipline. It is a spiritual practice. And of the spiritual practices, of the meditation practices, it's by far, in my opinion, at least for beginners, the most entertaining if we approach it with the right attitude, right? If we approach it as meditation rather than approaching it as personal expression or as entertainment.
Do you have the feeling that this is a kind of a trend or people seek to be entertained in spirituality?
I think that this is a troubling trajectory of modern society, of our addiction to screens, of shorter and shorter attention spans. I think this has been going on for a long time. I mean, I've read articles by people back in the 70s who were worried about televisions, right? Mm-hmm. You go back and you read about Plato, who is complaining about this newfangled technology called writing, and how this is going to ruin the memories of people. People are not going to be able to remember anything because they've become dependent upon written books. And this is something that's spoken of in the yogic tradition, how in the Kali Yuga, our mental powers are going to be diminished. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be so much distraction and so much adharma. And yet at the same time, all of the secrets are exposed. I mean, Sri Googleji, you can look up things on Google that you would have had to pay for in blood to learn from a tantric teacher, even a couple of decades ago. And so in this era of mass fake news, of adharma, of confusion, of distraction, right, of self-indulgent activities, of entertainment, of adharmic entertainment, of music that aggravates and provokes the ego rather than dissolves it, right, in this Kali Yuga. And this is not the Kali Yuga of Kali, the goddess Kali. This is Kali, who is a demon, short A, short I, Kali. So this is the era of asuric tendencies, of grasping after objects, but not just materialistic greed, what we might call spiritual greed, grasping after experiences, wanting to have certain experiences, wanting to have certain spiritual experiences, wanting to have emotional experiences. And those are objects also. They're subtle objects, but they are objects. And we can become addicted to experiences. We can become addicted to adrenaline. We can become addicted to oxytocin and just want to have pleasurable experiences all the time. Mm-hmm. This is why even back in the very ancient traditions, I know there's an old saying in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, they say, learn to eat bitter. Mm-hmm. Another famous saying is, when in the body of a donkey, learn to love the taste of grass. Like, we need to learn how to love experiences that are natural for us rather than constantly grasping after bigger and bigger spiritual experiences or more and more entertaining experiences or more and more data coming in stimulating our brain. And it is very dangerous because it tends to separate us from our inner knowing, from flowing awareness. It tends to entrench the discursive mind, and it tends to aggravate the personal ego and the sense of separation. And it's no wonder that people are having problems as a result in our society.
That's one of the long answers where as an interviewer, you're sitting there and just reflecting and just want to let it sink in. But unfortunately, this is audio and I have to say something. Yeah, I can so relate to of all of what you said. And
well, for me, asana yoga, because it has a physical component, it gets people back in their bodies. And I think it's a great antidote for modern people. And again, it's no wonder why it's become so popular. But it's not going to do its job properly if people and teachers allow it to simply become about feeling good or looking good or being healthy. Those are all materialistic goals. You need to understand.
Yeah,
everyone
also
needs to
sometimes
understand.
Sometimes I get really angry when I see it. Like I can't stand anymore another yoga burn class.
Yeah.
Like I really get angry like and think it's not what it is meant to be. It's it's not about handstand. Or not about burn your body fat to a minimum.
Yeah, when people say, how do I do the physical, how do I do the acrobatic move of having a handstand without understanding the alchemy of it, without understanding the why of it on a profound level, it's just gymnastics. Mm-hmm. And there are an awful lot of Olympic level gymnasts who can do handstand, but there are not many of them that are enlightened. So people are getting that backwards. They're getting it backwards. They're doing adharma, anti-dharma. They're going after the materialistic result rather than the spiritual revelation, and they're literally doing the practice backwards, literally backwards. They're moving their consciousness towards their individual body rather than towards unity or a realization of the interconnectivity of all phenomena.
You mentioned a lot dharma and adharma, and actually this was a question I received via Facebook for you. If you could explain your personal view what dharma and adharma means.
So dharma is one of those words that doesn't translate well into English. The easy answer, dharma is duty. But that's a very, how to put it, orthodox, stuck in the mud kind of definition of it. I could also say that dharma is nature. So truly being natural is dharmic, doing what is natural. And I don't mean natural in a hedonistic, like what feels good. That's a dharma, because again, dharma implies discipline, right? It implies duty. That's the first definition. But truly, when we're being our true selves, and when we're following a dharma, we know what our duty is, and we play our role elegantly. That's the example that Krishna gives to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, which is this huge, beautiful world classic that the entire point of the entire book is to describe how to do your dharma. That's the point of the Bhagavad Gita, is do your dharma. Krishna even says, better to do your dharma imperfectly than to do the dharma of another perfectly. It's better to learn and be clumsy in learning and doing what's proper and appropriate for you in this lifetime than to do something very well and get the results for it that isn't your dharma, isn't natural, isn't appropriate for you. So when we do our dharma, there is usually a characteristic side effect of increased happiness, increased luck, increased health, increased longevity, increased connectivity to other people, you know, meaningful friendships. And if those things are not happening, then the chances are you're probably not actually doing your dharma. Mm-hmm. So we can understand dharma as duty, doing what you're supposed to do, knowing your birth karma and doing it. Mm-hmm. But we can also understand is that's what's natural. And that's actually what feels good. Just like eating sugar, you know, gives us a temporary benefit. It tastes good, but actually in the long run, refined sugar is poison, right? And so we could say the same thing about a lot of entertaining experiences. It might feel good in the moment, but have toxic or negative results in the long term. And this is why we need to learn how to eat bitter. We need to learn how to relish life's challenges and difficulties, just like in a yoga asana class, we learn to recognize and work with and embrace discomfort so that we can open up our body and move out of habitual characteristic patterns, not only of motion, but of emotion. and become more fluid, watery, connected, loving human being. And I say watery because it's the cool flame. It's the watery flame, Pingala Nadi. It is both. It's sun and moon. That's the union of Shiva and Shakti, the cool flame of the central channel. And this is why, you know, to bring this back to where we started, we need to have both the sun and the moon. We need to have the Surya Namaskar and the Chandra Namaskar. And we need to have the math and we need to have the creativity. We need both. We need both. We need to exercise our whole mind, body, emotional, spiritual confluence of karmas that results in a human being appearing. That whole system needs to be used. And when we start saying, oh, I'm stiff, I can't do yoga, that's a self-imposed limitation. When somebody says, oh, I'm a creative person, I can't do math, that is a self-imposed limitation. When somebody says, I'm not spiritual, that's not natural. It isn't our nature. Our nature is to be the universe, ultimately. And along that way, we're going to be a complete human being. And again, that's the example that Krishna gives in the Bhagavad Gita. He was a lover. He was an artist. He was a flute player. He was a king. He had discipline. He was a warrior, right? He did all of those things. And that is what we should all be. We don't have to be Krishna, right? We can just be human. We don't have to be Einstein of physics or Picasso of art, right? We don't need to do that. We just need to, just like you don't need to be an Olympic gymnast to do asana yoga. But you need to not be afraid of all of those different sides of yourself and opening those sides of your brain, of exercising all of you. And that's really where this practice is meant to go. We're not supposed to stop with asana. And in sacred art, we're not supposed to stop with making pretty images. It's really designed to help open us to a more expansive idea of who we are and what we're capable of, becoming a full being.
Speaking of becoming a full being, a loving being, a human being, and being human, I do have a last question, if you still have time. I would be so interested how you live spirituality in your marriage.
Oh, yeah, that's a tough one. Like, the irony is my wife, who's a very devout Catholic, prayed for a spiritual husband.
No.
And she said, I don't care what religion he is. I don't care what he looks like. I just want to marry a spiritual husband. And we laugh about that now because she took me to my first yoga class. When mm-hmm. we first dated, remember I told you my spiritual practice was very secret? Mm-hmm. She's like, wow, I really like this guy, but I can't get married to him because he's not spiritual. Mm-hmm. And then as we were dating, she found out that I had this, like, I didn't like to admit it, but I had this kind of like, what I thought it was like the secret hippie spiritual woo-woo thing that I did in private. And she's like, okay, well, at least he meditates. At least he's spiritual. I can marry him now. And then when she took me to my first yoga class, I went there with her. She was going there just for the physical benefits as a workout. And then I just dove into this whole practice. And now I'm Hindu, which kind of, I think, we'll be diplomatic and say it annoys her. She says, I pray for your soul. And I'm like, keep praying. It's working. So how do we make that work? We're very different people and we honor and recognize and treasure our differences. I encourage her to go to church. I wouldn't say that she encourages me to study with my guru, but on the other hand, she doesn't oppose it. And she does give me time to do my practices. She's been extremely tolerant. I mean, she married Charles Ehlich. She didn't marry Ekabumi. Mm-hmm. So we had to really, she asked me, she's like, are we still married? You know, are you still Charles Ehlich? And I had to say, no, Charles Ehlich died in that ritual initiation. Mm-hmm. I'm Ekabumi. And she said, well, are we still married? I said, well, I still have Ekabumi's body. I still have his memories. I still love you. And if you want to stay married, we can do that. And I'm not saying it's been easy. It's been very, very hard. But with respect and with communication and with patience and with love, mm-hmm. Even somebody who is white can be married to somebody who's black. Somebody who is an English speaker can be married to somebody who's a Spanish speaker. Somebody who's Hindu can be married to somebody who is Catholic. And we've managed to make it work now for almost 20 years.
That's beautiful. And I think this is such a good example of how you live the teachings. Mm-hmm. It's always so easy when you're just meditating and sit on the cushion, and or if you are in trainings and hear the teachings, but how you show up in life and how you create your relationships and how which values do you live? This mm-hmm. is lived spirituality.
Well, I started approaching marriage, and this is even before I started doing yogic practice, I approached my relationships this way, that this is something that I needed for my sanity and for my health. Mm-hmm. And so there's a love and an enjoyment of being in relationship with somebody, but I started treating it as work. It's like, this is part of my health regime. I need to snuggle. I need hugs. There is such a thing as skin hunger. Mm-hmm. I need somebody in my life. Mm-hmm. And so I started treating that not just as a relationship for entertainment or for pleasure, but also as my health regime, as a discipline. And as a result, like I started, my girlfriend started asking me to marry them, because like when you maintain a garden, you don't stop watering the tree just because it's not flowering or there's no fruit on it. You water it all year round, even when it's not giving you the thing that you want, because that's what you do. That's your discipline. That's your relationship with that tree. So when I'm in relationship with somebody, when I'm in relationship with my wife, I continue giving back to the relationship even when it's not fun. Not because she deserves it, not because I want to, and not even because it's just a discipline, but because that's what it means to be in relationship. That's what I do. It's my mm-hmm. dharma. It's natural. So the marriage is as much a tapasya. You know, being monogamous in a relationship with somebody who's very different in many ways is a discipline. Mm-hmm. And I don't resent that work. I consider that part of my sadhana. And that's part of how it works. I mean, it could get dry and stale really quickly if it becomes just a mechanical activity. And the same thing with asana practice or meditation practice. It could get really stale and mechanical and dry very quickly. You have to bring the juice to it, which is why I love teaching about sacred art. It's beautiful. It's juicy. It excites your emotions. And we need that in our spiritual practice. Yeah. We absolutely need that to keep from getting crusty and dry and stale and mechanical. We need the music. We need the kirtan. We need the poetry. We need the statues and we need the paintings. We need that juicy, creative beauty. All that Shakti, we need to bring that Shakti to the Shiva, because Shiva is incomplete by himself.
This is so beautifully said. And what would be the next events where we could experience the juiciness of spiritual art and the juiciness of practicing with you? Even that sounds a bit weird.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm easy to find online. I do post regularly on Facebook. Mm-hmm. So I have lots of events coming up. I will be doing an event in May in Eugene, focused on building altars and using altars for spiritual practice. Mm-hmm. That's on my website, oneearthsacredarts.com. All one word, oneearthsacredarts.com. I do have lots of online courses, as we mentioned, at Living Sanskrit. I'm running retreats in India, through Mystic Art Retreats. So there's many, many ways, both in person, online, and in writing and in recorded classes, to get in touch with me, to learn about sacred art, and to get started. And frankly, if people just want to buy my coloring book, I really think that just coloring, spending time with the deity while chanting their mantra, is a great way to start. So people can just buy the Shakti coloring book or buy the Bhakti coloring book and just get started, you know, being playful. That's why it's a coloring book. It's not just for kids. It's just a way to be playful and creative, and nobody's looking at you. Nobody's telling you what to do, to build a playful and creative I like that, crayful, playful and creative, a crayful relationship with all of these incredible deities just by buying the book and try coloring in some of the images there.
I don't have it yet, but I will buy it directly. No, honestly, thank you so much. It was so, I have so much, I get so much inspiration from our talk.
Beautiful.
I think I will listen to it again and again and again. Because there's so much into it, and it was such a pleasure and such an honor, really. To, let me say that it's really an honor to have you on my podcast. Thank you so much, Jacob.
Well, I would ask you and the people listening this, I hope mm-hmm. it makes in the cut, to honor that I've shared very private information here. Within the tradition, speaking about your personal spiritual experiences is considered to be problematic. I don't want to set myself as an example. I certainly hope that other people doing sacred art don't expect to have the experiences I had. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to, my current guru, our first precept is you're not special. I'm really not trying to set myself up as being special. My hope is that people will hear these stories and be inspired to have their own experiences. As we talked about earlier, I think that this is actually natural, not special. That the point of doing yoga is to do your dharma, is to become more natural, not extraordinary, not magical. I think the universe is inherently magical, and we just need to sit and look with the artist's eyes and listen with the musician's ear and smell with the sommelier's nose and taste with the chef's tongue and realize just how magical the world is, just as it is right now.
I think this was
good.
I think listeners will hear this in every single word you said, your humbleness, your love for the goddess, the love for everything, and your passion and discipline for your way. And this is of so much, so much value. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Have a wonderful, wonderful day. And I look forward to hearing the podcast.
You too.
If you like this podcast, we would be super happy if you would rate us on Apple Podcast, or if you give us a follow on Apple iTunes or on Spotify. We want to say thank you for listening to House of Grace and wish you all the best. And hopefully you listen to us soon.